Hello and welcome to Friday Drive Time. This week we dedicate an hour to a close look at the Big Green Gathering, a cultural festival which has been taking place on farms in Wiltshire and Somerset for the last 10 years. It attracts about 20,000 people in August for nearly a week of practical green solutions, peace campaigning and political alternatives. But this year, the Big Green Gathering was cancelled at the last minute by Mendip District Council, Avon and Somerset Police and the gathering's directors due to a road closure order allegedly not being in place. Mendip District Council applied for an injunction against the organisers at the last minute, forcing them to give up the gathering's licence or face their own assets being seized and possible prison sentences. The consequences meant financial ruin for one of Britain's most important green get-togethers and has left the Big Green Gathering Limited bankrupt. The festival will probably never happen again. The ruin of this valuable cultural event follows hard on the heels of the bankruptcy last year of the equally popular Ashton Court Festival. I spoke to one of the Big Green's organisers, Brig Oobridge, who began by explaining the roots of the Big Green in the 1970s, the free festivals like Stonehenge.
Back in the early 1980s, we had green gatherings in a time when it was a lot easier to organise events and you weren't tied down by so many rules and regulations. And that was an initiative that came out of early members of the Green Party, which was then known as the Ecology Party, and we had an Ecology Party summer gathering was the first one, on Michael Eavis's land, Worthy Farm, where the Glastonbury Festival takes place. And we had green gatherings there for 3 years, I think it was, until Mendip Council told Michael he couldn't have more than one event on his land. And we had another one near Pilton on another site. And then in 1984, Michael acquired more land and said to the people who'd been organising the old green gatherings, I'd like you to come on board with me and set up these green fields at Glastonbury Festival, which of course have gone on ever since. We had one more of the old green gatherings in 1984, which was at Molesworth in Cambridgeshire, which was destined to be the second Greenham Common type cruise missile base. And we had an event there on the MOD land, which turned into an occupation of that land all winter, which became known as the Rainbow Village and was finally evicted by Michael Heseltine and 3,500 troops and police. People might remember the pictures of Michael Heseltine arriving in his flak jacket by helicopter to oversee the operation. And that was 1985, February 85, when Heseltine came and evicted us from there. And people may remember 85 was also the year of the miners' strike. It was the year of Stonehenge, big confrontation between police and people trying to set up a free festival at Stonehenge, and known as the Beanfield. And after that, you couldn't get a festival site, not for a number of years afterwards, and events went small scale, so that, little camps for 300 people or so.
Was that because farmers just weren't cooperating anymore? There weren't any sympathetic farmers, and they were worried that
well, whether they were sympathetic or not, they were worried, and there was an awful lot of scare stories in the media about peace convoys and dreadful people rampaging around the country.
But wasn't there some justification to that because of the Molesworth thing? And, well, you'd come on to Molesworth and you decided to occupy it and stay there.
Well, that was a political protest on MOD land. That was an entirely different thing. So things gradually eased off after that. And by the early 90s, 1993, at that time I was coordinating the TP field in the green fields at Glastonbury Festival. And a friend of mine, Anne Waterhouse, who'd also been involved in the old green gatherings, was coordinating the whole of the green fields. And sometime after Glastonbury Festival that year, we met up for dinner and found that we'd both been going round the green fields at Glastonbury, having the same conversations with our old mates, saying, isn't it time that we had our own big green gathering again? And so we wrote to a number of our friends in the festival scene and in the green movement and said, we're hiring a room in Bristol. If you want to come and be part of setting up a new green gathering event, then come along, and everyone who pays up in advance will get to be a shareholder of it. So it was set up from the beginning on a democratic basis with a lot of shareholders, each with one share. And that's the way that it's been run ever since. And we've had big green gatherings since 1994, so it would have been 15 years this year. And it's grown over that time from a small event the first year with 1,600 people to 17,000, actually licensed for 20,000 people. And it's grown gradually over that time and become Britain's, probably Europe's, premier green open-air event.
That was old style Stonehenge favourites Hawkwind there with Damnation Alley from their Quark, Strangeness and Charm album. And now we return to my interview with Brig Ubridge, organiser of the Big Green Gathering, which was cancelled and bankrupted after Mendip District Council applied for an injunction to revoke the festival's licence this summer.
There are other events that have followed the Big Green Gathering in trying to be green, but we've really been at the cutting edge all the way through. We're not a music festival. We're a festival of lifestyle, of education, of pushing the green issues with music and entertainment and lots of good fun along with it. And we were at the cutting edge of saying we're not going to have noisy generators thumping in the background to produce electricity. From the very first Big Green Gathering, we said we're going to do it all on wind and solar and pedal power and renewable resources.
Well, that's not very easy for someone who's, say, trying to run a cinema. How are they going to get the power to run the projector and the DVD player and all that kind of thing?
Well, we've shown that it can be done, and we've reached a point where actually, there were so many people who wanted to come to the Big Green Gathering and put on their show, that they got themselves set up with solar panels, with wind turbines, with battery power, to be able to produce a show in that way. And at this year's Big Green Gathering, we would have had, I think, at least four solar cinemas, and half a dozen stages of one sort or another, including the big one is Croissant Neuf, which is set up. It's like a nightclub for 1,000 people, all run off the solar panels, which you could fit on the roof of an average-sized terraced house, which just shows what can be done. And by doing it that way, we've been an inspiration to thousands of people who've come to the Big Green Gathering over the years to see exactly what can be done with small-scale technology and cutting your suit according to the cloth, which is what you've got to do with renewables. No good expecting a solar panel on the roof to behave in the same way as a nuclear power station down the road. But if you know what you're doing and you organise your consumption to match the supply, then you can do everything that you want to do. And there's no reason why the green revolution that we've all got to go through, the change of attitudes, change of lifestyle consumption practices, which is necessary, absolutely necessary, to save this planet turning into something that people can't actually live on. It doesn't have to be a hair shirt revolution. You know, we can, with the technology, do everything that we need to do, everything that makes our lives comfortable, and provide hundreds of thousands of jobs along the way, if we go about it the right way. And that's the inspiration that the Big Green Gathering over the years has been providing. And what's kept me going, organising it, has been the number of people every year who come up to me and say, thank you for doing this, it's changed my life. And it has been a life-changing event for thousands of people.
Are you happy about the economic crisis? Because that is forcing people to rethink their energy needs and all sorts of other things. Do you think that actually may be a green element to that, that it may actually help transform people more into renewable energy and that kind of thing?
There's things we can take from it. And actually, you know, the Chinese say that crisis is the same word as opportunity. And it does give us an opportunity. One thing we can certainly take from the credit crunch and the measures that have been taken to keep the economy going is the lesson that money doesn't grow on trees. If money grew on trees, it'd be in limited supply, like peaches and apricots and walnuts. But it doesn't. It's something that's created mostly by tapping figures into computers nowadays. It used to be by printing off banknotes, and before that it was something real because it was metal that was mined out of the ground. But nowadays it's something that's just created by governments and banks by writing figures in ledgers. And that's what they've done with the credit crunch. That's where they found these billions and trillions of dollars that they've pumped back into the banks to keep the system afloat. And it's proved that there is no excuse to say we can't do things because we haven't got the money. Because, you know, as was the case in wartime, the money can always be found if it's really needed, if people appreciate the need for it. And there is a need now for investment in renewable technologies, in investment in insulating all our homes, in investment in transforming an economy which spews out waste all over the place, spews out pollution all over the place, and is destroying the planet, to one that conserves resources, that uses non-polluting technologies, and can give us a sustainable future, not just for ourselves, but our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and for hundreds of years to come, which, living on the oil boom as we've done for the last 100 years, cannot do, and is doing the exact opposite, is destroying the planet that we live on.
Vinnie Clark, and Hearing Voices. Now we return to my interview with Brig Ubridge, organiser of the Big Green Gathering, which was cancelled and bankrupted after Mendip Council applied for an injunction to revoke the festival's licence this summer.
Now, you did have several blips, didn't you, between the 1990s and up to the present, but quite a lot of years off with the Green Gathering. Why was that?
Well, the first time that we had a year off was 1999, when we wanted to put in a big effort and do something special for 2000. We actually applied for one of those Millennium grants and got to the next to last stage. We were shortlisted and didn't get a grant after putting a lot of work in. We had a year off in 2001. That was the year of the foot and mouth outbreak, when we were very fortunate that we decided to have a year off then, because we wouldn't have been able to run it anyway. We had a year off in 2004 because our event in 2003 on the Mendips near Cheddar got very heavily rained on. It was a record wet July, and all the rain fell in the last week of July, which was when we were actually getting people on site for our event. It stopped raining on the weekend of the event itself, but that was something like 7 inches of rain we had in 6 days, a phenomenal amount. And the farm needed a year to recover after that because it had got so muddy.
I think I'm right in saying that last year, 2008, you also didn't have a festival. Why was that?
That was because 2007 had turned out to be so expensive to us.
So that was the last one, the 2007.
That was the last one, 2007. And we based our budgeting for it on the license that we'd been granted for 2006. And when it came to 2007, the police were insisting on so much extra security, both in terms of physical security people and in terms of steel shield fencing and so on, that put our security costs up by £100,000 and our site costs up by £60,000. And we ended up making a huge loss on it because, of course, these licensing conditions didn't get finalised until sometime in June. And all the budgeting had been done 6 months or more before then.
So what was the big difference from the police's point of view? Why did they decide that you needed all this extra security for 2007?
I'm afraid you'd have to ask them that. It was a different policeman on the job. The inspector who we'd had in 2006 and 2005 had said, I don't see why we need any policing at all on this festival. It's, you know, very peaceful. Really don't know why we're involved. The policeman that we got in 2007 in charge of it was new to the area, new to festivals. I don't know if it's true, but the rumour had it that he'd been transferred from the terrorist squad from the Met, but he certainly went on in meetings about the need to target harden the event and was using that sort of language, which comes from that sort of obsession with security, and he was applying it in entirely the wrong place.
Well, couldn't you sort of negotiate with the police at that point and say, well, actually, no, that we don't need to target harden the Green Gathering because it's not a terrorist target? Is there some room for negotiation?
There's some room for negotiation in these things, but there was a new licensing act which came in, actually first operated in regard to festivals in 2006. It was the same licensing act which made for 24-hour pub opening, and there was a bit of a kerfuffle at the time about the licensing of music coming under it and people not being able to get out a guitar in a pub and have a sing-song anymore unless it was specially licensed. But what people don't realise is that what they did is put together all the different types of licensing, for the alcohol licensing, music licenses, even for licenses for premises providing cups of tea after 11 o'clock at night, and put them all into one package, one act. And under that, rather than in the old licensing, alcohol was done by the justices of the peace in the court. Local council was responsible for music licenses, but you could appeal to the court. It made it so all of these came under the district council, and the police had a role as statutory consultees, which in practice has actually given them virtually a veto on any kind of licensing. And if they don't agree to it, then the councillors, who vote as a committee on whether to grant the licence, just aren't going to go against the police. So the police have a huge amount of power in the process since 2006.
So you were hit by this in 2007. What happened to your finances as a result of that?
As a result of that, we had to refinance the company, because we came out of it with a pile of bills that was £200,000 tall, and £50,000 left in the kitty to pay them off with. So we actually raised £50,000 in new shares and donations. We entered into a relationship with a commercial music promoter, Stuart Galbraith, who was initially said he was going to advance us £150,000, but in the end, when the credit crunch hit, could only advance us £50,000. And we got other money in from shareholders in the Green Gathering, actually putting forward chunks of their savings on a 3-year loan basis to the company. So although it took some over a year to do, we were able to pay off all of those bills from 2007 and set ourselves up to go again this year, 2009. We were actually very proud of ourselves that in the credit crunch, which had done for everyone from Woolworths to General Motors, we'd managed to come through it and be all set to run another event in 2009.
That was the Headmix Collective with Duddle Uddle. Now, back to the interview with Brig Ubridge, organiser of the Big Green Gathering, which was cancelled and bankrupted this summer after Mendip District Council applied for an injunction to revoke the festival's licence.
Stuart Security, what was the original arrangement with them, and why was it that they decided that they wanted all their money up front? And how long before the event did they approach you to tell you this?
Some months before the event, they told us that, and to an extent that was reasonable because they'd been our perimeter security firm in 2007. In fact, we'd been using them ever since 2002. And like a number of other contractors, they had had to wait after the 2007 event before they finally got all of their money, and they got that in installments after the 2007 event as we succeeded in raising funds to refinance the company. And we were quite happy with that, but a problem did occur, because what had happened in previous years was that because most people book nowadays over the internet, and this has been an increasing phenomenon over the past few years, most of our advance booking money comes that way. And although when you book something over the internet, the money comes straight away out of your account, if you're the Big Green Gathering waiting for the ticket money, it doesn't come straight to us. It goes into a company called NetBanks, which is a bank set up by a consortium of the high street clearing banks to handle internet transactions. And they may have different deals with different sorts of company, but in regard to the Big Green Gathering, their deal is that they hold on to the money for a couple of months before we get it. So with the bulk of our bookings coming in the last couple of months before the event, you can see that there was a big pile of money there that we couldn't actually get our hands on. And whereas in previous years our bank has given us an overdraft to cover that, this year with the credit crunch, they were a lot slower coming forward with the overdraft. They did in the end, but they took a bit of convincing. And so therefore, just over 2 weeks before the event, when it was on a Monday when we were due to pay Stuart Security on the Wednesday, I phoned up Bill Stuart of Stuart Security and said, Bill, look, we've got the money in bookings sitting there, but the bank won't come through with the overdraft to let us access it. Is there any flexibility in this deadline of getting you fully paid up by Wednesday? And he said, no, sorry, that's business. No flexibility at all. And the police were on to me before you got your license to find out the terms of our contract, and I've no doubt that they will be on to me on Wednesday to find out whether I have been paid. And as it happened, the bank came through with the overdraft on the Wednesday afternoon, but on the Wednesday lunchtime, whilst I was waiting for the bank to come through with the decision, I got a phone call from Chief Inspector Paul Richards of Avon and Somerset Police, informing me that Stuart Security had pulled out. At which point, of course, we then looked for other possible security contractors, and
that was because they hadn't received the money that morning. By that morning,
that was because there hadn't been a check received at their office on the Wednesday morning.
So were they asking for all of their payment for policing the gathering, doing the security on the gathering, by that date? Or was there an arrangement by which you paid, say, half before and half after the festival?
No, they wanted it all in advance. But, of course, when we then started contacting other security companies once Stuart's had withdrawn, we found another company, Coast to Coast Security, which is of equally good standing, you know, does events at the Bath and West Showground within Mendip's area. And they were prepared to do it with less of the money up front, and for a slightly cheaper price. So at that point, I had to say to Bill Stewart, well, sorry, Bill, that's business. But
he'd already said that they they'd
already withdrawn. But I did get back to them and gave them a chance to come back on board again if they wanted to, because the overdraft had been granted that afternoon. But they didn't, and we got a better offer from Coast to Coast Security. But from that point on, we were under tremendous pressure from the, mostly from the police, about our contractors, whether they'd all been paid up front, when was the fence going up. We had police coming up to the site in advance and saying, well, you haven't started putting the fence up yet. Our site manager said, no, we got professional company putting it up, and they come in tomorrow and start, and it'll be up in time. And we had the police phoning up our contractors to see if they'd been paid in advance, and so on, all sorts of pressure on us. And it was as if that from that point on, they were trying to find a weak point and an excuse to close us down.
Well, why do you say that? I mean, surely the police's job is just to make sure that you're doing what you've said you're going to do, and that's part of their job, isn't it?
Well, during our discussions that we had with them over the weekend before the gathering, during which time they were threatening to take out a High Court injunction on the Monday morning to stop it if we didn't voluntarily surrender our licence on the Sunday, Chief Inspector Richard said to me that he had actually decided a fortnight before that it wasn't going to take place.
But was that at the same time as this Stewart Security pulled out?
It was actually, that would actually have been slightly before Stewart Security pulled out, if judging by what he said. And there was, from that point on, a whole series of hoops erected that we had to jump through to satisfy them that we had everything together for the event, which weren't hoops that were erected by or comprised any part of the license conditions, because you have license conditions that set up certain hurdles. You've got to do this by such and such a date and so on. But these were additional requirements that were being placed on us. And you know, we jumped through all of those hoops. We got an alternative security company that was perfectly acceptable. We got contracts in place with them. Everything was on course. And then the one thing that stopped us was the road closure.
That was the Mordeckers with Rumba. Now back to the interview with Brig Ubridge, organiser of the Big Green Gathering, which was cancelled and bankrupted after Mendip District Council applied for an injunction to revoke the festival's licence.
Well, I've got a letter here from Mendip District Council dated 24th of July, which was up on the internet. And what they're saying, there are some fundamental issues and they're expressing concern that you won't be able to actually fulfil your licence conditions. They say, first of all, there is a lack of assurance that you have a security company contracted to provide event security in accordance with the licence conditions.
Well, that was nonsense, because we did have a security company contracted, Coast to Coast Security, for the external, Green Security for the internal, and on the very date of that letter, there had been a multi-agency meeting up at the site at Fernhill Farm, where the directors of both of those companies were present and gave full verbal assurances to the council and the police and everyone else who was present that there were contracts in place, that they had been paid in advance in accordance with those contracts, and that they would be there providing the service. So that was a complete red herring, that one.
The next one down the list is a lack of assurance that you have a traffic management company contracted to provide traffic management and signage in accordance with the licence conditions.
The licence conditions didn't require us to have a traffic management company as such. They required us to have a traffic management plan, which we had and which had been approved as part of the licence. In regard to the signage, there was a glitch in that the company which had normally been providing us with signage in previous years declined to do it, because like other contractors we'd been slow paying them after the 2007 event, and so we did have to find alternative providers for that at the last minute. But that was done. They were, you know, the signs were sourced. They were going to come from Sun Traffic in Somerton, which is a local company. They do Glastonbury Festival and so on, and the signs that they couldn't provide from their own stock were actually going to be made by Bath Signs in Bath, who are fully approved supplier of traffic signs to a number of traffic management companies that provide signs for roadworks, etc., etc.
Okay, the next one, they say there's a lack of assurance that you have obtained a road closure order, or that you can obtain one in time for the running of the event.
And this is a very peculiar one, because the road closure order is issued by Somerset County Council Highways Department, and because
not by Mendip District Council who organised the licensing. No. Okay.
And I had been assured by the BODs in the Highways Department in their Glastonbury office, which covered the area, that everything would be fine and the road closure order would be granted. There was some of the paperwork had to be changed because of the change of the signs company. The plans had to have the name of the new signs providers on it rather than the old ones, so the paperwork had to be revised and got back into them. But it was exactly the same map of where the signs went, the same schedule of what the signs were, as had been perfectly fine and acceptable in 2006 and 2007. And on the Friday before the event, the young chap in the Highways Department who'd been left in charge while his boss went on holiday came back to me I spoke to him on the telephone. He said, I'm under tremendous pressure from the district council, from the police, and from the county solicitor. get your stuff in by lunchtime. And I got the stuff in by lunchtime, and I got an email back from him giving me alleged reasons why the paperwork, which had been perfectly fine in 2006 and 2007, was somehow not up to the mark in 2009. And couldn't get back to him because they weren't answering the phones or replying to emails in that department on the Friday afternoon. And at 6:45 on the Friday evening, our solicitor received by email from Mendip District Council a set of papers for a High Court injunction hearing on the Monday morning in London, High Court in the Strand, which said, amongst other things, that we had not obtained and could not obtain the road closure order. On the basis of that, we were advised by a QC that if we went to the High Court and couldn't provide this road closure order, then we were just laying ourselves open to many thousands of pounds of High Court costs, and he advised us to surrender the license on the Sunday. That we did, and we were under an awful lot of pressure from the police to do so, and threats that if we didn't do so, then they would not only keep the £27,000 that we'd paid them up front for policing the event, which they've still done and not returned, but would also be going after individual directors of the Green Gathering or even the farmer for the balance of any policing costs that they had in preventing the event going ahead, as well as us being personally liable for High Court costs and the like, or for to be jailed for breach of an injunction were any gathering to take place. Now, against all of that pressure, and with the advice of a QC, we surrendered the license on the Sunday. On the Monday or Tuesday, going around the site, we found that the road closure order, the actual notices giving the order saying this road will be closed for the period of the Green Gathering, had been posted, had been put up on gate posts and telegraph poles around the lanes. So the order was in fact in place. The paperwork needed tidying up back at the office, but the order was actually in place. And because of that, and because the injunction papers that were served on us by Mendip District Council and the police actually had wrong information in them upon which our QC based his advice to us, we are now in discussion with high-powered city lawyers about who we can take to court, who we can sue for this closing down of our event, which has not only done damage to the Big Green Gathering company, I mean, we're left with all the people who paid for tickets, all the people who paid for stalls, requiring their money back, and obviously a large amount of that money has been spent on the setting up the site and so on. But it's also done about £2 million worth of damage to the local economy, because that's how much money people coming to the Big Green Gathering spend in the local economy. And we're, over the years that we've been in Somerset, we have been integrating ourselves into the local economy. There's local farmers and producers who produce food and organic vegetables and so on for the Big Green Gathering. There's a local brewery that produced £30,000 worth of real ale, especially for the Big Green Gathering, and had to pour it away because it wouldn't keep and they hadn't got anywhere else to sell it to. And shopkeepers in Cheddar, in Wells, who got in extra stock because they know that when the Big Green Gathering comes to town, it empties the shelves. You know, all of these people took a hit from it, and we reckon it did at least £2 million of damage to the local economy, let alone the damage that it did to individual ticket buyers and to the Big Green Gathering itself.
That was Wishbone Ash, The King Will Come. Now back to the interview with Brig Ubridge about the Big Green Gathering, which was cancelled this summer after Mendip District Council applied for an injunction to revoke the festival's licence.
Who do you point the finger of blame at for this injunction then? If you were ready to go, do you think it was the District Council or the police that were really behind this? Or maybe somebody else or another body?
People have come forward with all sorts of conspiracy theories. We know there was a conspiracy in that there were people working together with the aim of stopping the Green Gathering happening. But people can be working for the same aim from different motivations. Anything I say would be supposition. It's certainly the case, as George Monbiot pointed out in a full-page article in The Guardian that people may have seen, that the Big Green Gathering is a key get-together for people who are involved in green campaigning. People like the plain stupid people who've been protesting about the expansion of Heathrow Airport, and people like the climate camp people who set up a camp on Blackheath on the edge of London just last week. And there are people at government level who regard that as a kind of rocking the boat they'd rather not see. It's also quite possible that our change of security company put one or two noses out of joint for some reason or other. There are security companies who don't feel that there's a level playing field in terms of choice of security companies for events around this area. And in various meetings over the years, it's been made clear to us, although of course it couldn't be said officially, that Stuart Security were a preferred company. So whether that is an aspect of motivating some kind of conspiracy, I don't know. I can only surmise. Maybe there were some people just didn't like the cut of our jib and were after getting at us one year or another if they could. But what we do know is that it was unjustified that although we did have quite a lot of pressure on cash flow, we did have the resources there to pay all the bills and do everything that was necessary to comply with the license. And we were blocked and put in a position where to go forward would have exposed us and the farmer to an awful lot of personal risk, and not just financial risk, but risk of being jailed as well if the event went ahead despite our efforts, if people just turned up for it. And that it's done an immense amount of damage to the local economy, and people in the area can't understand why the council did it. And this was council officials. It wasn't the elected councillors. It was council officials driving this. And behind that, it was the police driving the council officials. And according to what we were told in meetings on the police side, the orders were coming from chief constable level. And Inspector Richards, who was the chief Inspector Richards, who was the one we were dealing with at ground level, said his gold commander was the chief constable. That was where the orders came from that he had to implement.
Now, one of the festival organisers has said that Chief Inspector Paul Richards, who was your festival liaison, as you just said that the injunction was political.
I wasn't at the meeting where he said that, and the word political is open to lots of interpretations, and you know, that could be anything from big government type politics to local office politics.
Well, of course, many districts
they're all covered by the term politics one way or another. So you'd have to ask Paul Richards what he meant by that. But he was asked, you know, is it political? And he said it's partly to do with the concern about whether you could fulfil the licence conditions. And yes, it's partly political. That's what my colleague who was in the meeting with him reported back to us. You would have to ask him what he meant, and maybe we'll find out or not in the long term.
With the benefit of hindsight, do you think it would have been better to fight that injunction at the High Court on the Monday? Now we know that some of the facts that were in the injunction being put forward by Mendip District Council and the police were incorrect.
If we had found those notices on the posts in the lane before we made the decision to hand back the licence, we wouldn't have handed back the licence. We would have fought that in the High Court, I am sure. And finding those would have changed the advice that we were given by the QC. Because it's then down to a legal argument as to whether the road closure order is made when the notices go up on posts saying this road will be closed. This order is made by Somerset County Council dated the 20th of July, or whether it's made on the 25th or the 26th of July when the paperwork is tidied in a bundle and the rubber stamp is put on it in the office. And once we did find those notices, and most of them had been taken away, we found a couple that had been left behind, one that had fallen down the back of a hedge. If we had had that information when we were deciding to hand back the licence, I'm sure we would have fought it in the High Court. And our QC was very, very, very annoyed that he'd actually given us wrong advice on the basis of untrue information in the papers prepared for the injunction hearing by Mendip District Council. And we're still consulting with lawyers. We don't know whether this will result in action through the courts or possibly through the local government ombudsman, who can also award compensation. But whatever way, it was not straightforward. It was not completely above board. The reasons that were given for seeking this injunction, you know, and we've been through them, most of them were nonsense. And the one about the road closure order was highly dubious. And there is certainly a case there to be answered from our side. And we will see what answers come from it, but we're certainly not letting it rest.
Brig Ubridge there, talking to me the other day about the cancellation and subsequent bankruptcy of Somerset's Big Green Gathering Festival, after a last-minute High Court injunction to stop the festival was applied for by Mendip District Council. And as Brig says, now it appears the road closure order, which the police and council say they needed, may have been in place, so there may be legal action against Mendip District Council. I'll be back next week with the usual live programme, where my guests and I will be examining controversial proposals to build two new nuclear power stations at Hinkley and Oldbury in the Bristol Channel. So from me, Tony Gosling, it's goodbye until 5pm next Friday, and do have a peaceful weekend.